The fifth case, the United States versus Harris. Mr. Newman.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Newman, and I'm appearing pro bono publico on behalf of the appellant, David W. Harris. We raised three issues in our brief, but because of the time limitations, I'm going to focus my attention today on the first of those issues, and that is the erroneous admission of hearsay evidence. The district court in this case improperly admitted hearsay evidence, and that error was not harmless. The challenged evidence was hearsay because the confidential informant testified about out-of-court statements that Mr. Cannon supposedly made, and those out-of-court statements were offered for their truth. The district court committed two errors in admitting the CI's statements. One was a procedural error. The other was a substantive error. Neither was harmless. First, the district court erred procedurally. The district court in this case failed to use any of the procedures that this court has set forth in United States versus Hunt and elsewhere for admitting evidence pursuant to Rule 801 D2E. That is, the district court did not make a preliminary determination based on a Santiago proffer. No Santiago proffer was filed in this case. The court did not rule on each statement as it was elicited at trial. The court did not conditionally admit the evidence, subject to eventual supporting evidence. And the court did not hold a full-blown pretrial hearing to consider all of the evidence.
But all that's not important if the total of the trial actually showed that the statements were admissible and the co-conspirator exception.
Thank you, Judge. I believe that the procedures that this court set forth in Hunt may not necessarily be mandatory. However, the district court committed an additional procedural error in this case in that the district court failed to make any explicit findings under Rule 104 as to whether any of the three foundational elements of Rule 801 D2E had been satisfied. So perhaps had the district court not followed any of the Hunt procedures but had made findings under Rule 104, perhaps we'd be in a different place. But the fact remains that the district court did neither. The district court neither made any findings under Rule 104, nor did it follow any of the procedures set forth in Hunt.
Cannon and Harris are cousins.
They are cousins.
And if the record discloses that they were co-conspirators, then these procedural irregularities that you point out, and David correctly point out, kind of drop out of the case, don't they?
Well, this court has previously said in United States versus Stevenson and elsewhere that it will search the record and make a determination as to whether or not a conspiracy was proven and the other two elements of 801 D2E were proven by a preponderance of the evidence. However, in this case, we don't believe that that's an appropriate procedure, principally because of the important role that the credibility of the confidential informant plays in determining whether or not the government proved the existence of a conspiracy by a preponderance of the evidence. And that because the district court judge, made no findings under Rule 104, we have no way of knowing whether or not the district court found the confidential informant's testimony to be credible. And therefore, because there is no credibility determination, and because the determination hinges so principally on the testimony of that confidential informant, that I believe in this case it would be inappropriate for this court to use the procedures that it set forth in Stevenson, even if it wants to determine that those procedures may be usable in certain cases. So in this case, the district court failed to even enunciate any of the elements that the government had to prove or the standards by which those elements had to be proven. And the Tenth Circuit has said that when a district court doesn't make the necessary findings, a reviewing court, quote, cannot be certain that the court ever actually evaluated the evidence and ascertained that the Rule 801 D2E requirements were satisfied. We believe that the district court committed a substantive error in this case as well, because there was insufficient evidence to support a finding that a conspiracy existed, even under a preponderance of the evidence. As I stated before, the court should remand this case to the district court so that it can make those determinations with respect to the 801D2E elements in the first instance. Now, the government concedes that the district court failed to make explicit findings, but yet it asks this court to make those findings for the government. As I've stated, I believe that it's a superior procedure, particularly in this instance, for the court to remand the case to the district court, at least for the limited purpose of permitting the district court to make those findings. The Supreme Court has stated that it's the trial court that should resolve whether conspiracy existed and whether the defendant participated in it. The Tenth Circuit referred to it as questionable for an appeals court to presume that a trial judge made implicit findings and then search the record for evidence that the trial court may have relied upon to support those findings. But importantly, it's the unique facts of this case which we believe make the at least the limited remand centrally important here. And that is, as I've stated, the central role that the CI's credibility plays and the fact that no fact finder at the district court level made a determination with respect to the confidential informant's credibility, at least as it pertains to the existence of a conspiracy. And so in that case, in that sense, this is the 801D2E problem here presents something of a perfect storm, and it's something of an exceptional case, and that is the district court made no explicit findings regarding any of the elements. The district court gave no indication that it considered what the government had to prove or the standards by which it had to prove it. Evaluating whether or not the government carried its burden turns principally on the credibility of one witness. No fact finder determined that the confidential informant was telling the truth about the existence of a conspiracy. And in fact, the jury in this case acquitted Mr. Harris on the conspiracy count, despite the fact that the confidential informant had presented inculpating testimony. Now, I concede, of course, that the district court judge would have considered the existence of a conspiracy under the preponderance of the evidence standard, whereas the jury was considering the existence of a conspiracy by beyond a reasonable doubt standard for determining guilt. But nevertheless, in this case, I would offer that the acquittal is important for at least the following limited purpose, and that is because the district court failed to make any credibility determination with respect to whether the confidential informant was telling the truth about the existence of a conspiracy, it seems particularly perilous for this court to simply credit that testimony as true in light of the jury's acquittal. We also, again, have stated...
Of course, on the knowing possession, he was arrested in the car with all the cocaine.
He was in the car where the cocaine was found. That's true.
And he had $8,900 in cash on his person.
That's also true.
Rather unusual.
That's very problematic for you.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Harris had been traveling a long distance and was visiting from out of town, and so he had a large amount of cash with him in the context of that trip. Although we submit that even the fact that he was found in the car and that he had cash in his pocket does not create the existence of a conspiracy by a preponderance of the evidence. And because of the procedural error and because of the substantive error that the district court made, we ask that this court, at the very least, remand the case to the district court so they can make those findings. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Hanstead?
Good morning or good afternoon, and may it please the court. Gregory Hanstead for the United States. I wanted to address a number of issues that were raised by the defendant, both in his briefs and here today at oral argument. First, the defendant contends that the district court erred by allowing the confidential informant, in this case, Corey Anderson, to testify about out-of-court statements that were made by Mark Cannon. Counsel is right. While it is clear that the district court failed to make explicit findings regarding the foundational elements of 801D2E, it is also clear that the evidence in the trial record would support such findings. And because that is the case, the district court did not err in admitting those statements. Now, counsel is also right that much of the determination in this regard hinges on the credibility of a confidential informant, Corey Anderson. And at least in the defendant's brief, he argued that there is evidence in the record that cuts against finding Mr. Anderson credible, and specifically points to the fact that he's a government cooperator and that he's an admitted drug user. But those are, for good or for bad, the types of witnesses that conspiracy, drug conspiracy cases are always built upon. And the inquiry really is whether the record, again, would support the district court's decision to admit the statements. And here, the government submits that there is ample evidence in the record that would support the district court's decision to admit those statements. In short, Anderson not only provides these statements and this testimony, but the testimony that he provides is corroborated in a number of important respects. In short, Anderson testifies that an individual from Arkansas is up visiting the individual's cousin, Mark Cannon, in Milwaukee. They're driving a green Ford Excursion with Arkansas license plates, and that there's cocaine in the truck. And when officers stop the defendant, he is in that green Ford Excursion bearing Arkansas license plates with his cousin Mark Cannon. And when the officers later search the vehicle, they find cocaine in the truck just as the informant, Mr. Anderson, said there was.
Now, you said in your brief on page 6, the informant told Detective Paschal the cocaine was sealed in the Excursion.
Right.
Wasn't that answer objected to and the objection sustained?
I don't recall specifically, but I know that there was some disagreement over what it was that the informant had told Detective Paschal, whether he said that there was cocaine in the truck or whether he had seen cocaine in the truck. And I believe that the transcript at page 174, the trial transcript that is, where it comes down basically is that Detective Paschal testified that Anderson said he knew there was cocaine in the truck, but she didn't pin him down specifically on whether he had actually seen the cocaine in the truck.
Yeah, that she admitted that he never told her that he saw the cocaine in the Excursion, because that has some bearing on the probable cause.
Correct.
As well.
Correct. But again, at the evidentiary hearing, the transcript at page 15, and then at the trial transcript, page 174, it is clear that Detective Paschal testified that Anderson never said that he saw cocaine in the truck, but he did say that he knew cocaine was in the truck. It's just unclear how it is that he knew that, whether it was because somebody told him that or whether he deduced it because they were trying to get rid of cocaine and they were traveling in that Ford Excursion.
Why didn't the police get a warrant here?
At the time, the police were having some difficulty finding exactly where the Excursion was, and it was sort of a fluid situation. The Excursion was going between two residences that Cannon owned, and it was going from those residences to other places trying to deliver cocaine. So it wasn't clear when it was that the officers were going to be able to locate the Excursion, where it would be, when they located it, and at what stage in the process Cannon and Harris would be when they located the truck. That is, whether they would have just gotten rid of the cocaine or whether they'd still be in the process of trying to deliver 1 or 2 kilograms.
Was there anything done to corroborate the confidential informant's statements?
No, again, it was all happening very quickly. Now, there were some of the more innocent aspects of the informant statements were corroborated. That is, the fact that this Green Ford Excursion was going to be found at one of Cannon's residences, and there was a specific detailed description given not only of the Ford Excursion with the Arkansas license plates, but also where it would be found. Those sorts of things were corroborated by police surveillance. But nothing specifically corroborated about whether there was cocaine in the Excursion or not. So again, while this case hinges on largely on, or while this issue hinges largely upon Anderson's credibility, there is ample evidence in the record to establish that that he was credible, or from which the district court could have determined that he was credible, including not only the things I've already mentioned, but again also the fact that when the Green Ford Excursion is stopped, not only are Cannon and Harris in the Excursion, not only is there cocaine in the Excursion, all as Anderson had said, but also, again, when Harris is searched outside of the vehicle, he has two baseball-sized rolls of cash, one in each pocket, for a total of $8,900. Again, from these facts, not only in themselves help to establish the existence of the conspiracy, but they also help to corroborate the information that was provided by Anderson and to establish his credibility. Now, the defendant also argued in his brief, and I just was going to touch briefly on this second issue, and that is the notion that the district court erred in finding that the collective knowledge of the investigating officers failed to establish probable cause to support the stop and subsequent search of the Ford Excursion. Because these officers, this chain of officers, beginning with Detective Pascio, who was in direct communication with the informant, Corey Anderson, that in the chain that includes the officers to whom she relayed the information that was provided by Anderson, including ultimately at the end of the chain, the officers who conducted the stop of the vehicle. Because they were in, they were all members of the same unit, they were all in communication with one another, they were all involved in this joint enterprise to locate and stop this green Ford Excursion in which Harris and Cannon were traveling trying to deliver cocaine. The collective knowledge of each of these officers can be imputed to one another, and that being the case, looking at what it was that Corey Anderson had provided by way of information to Detective Pascio, who then passed it on to everybody else, so you have a situation where an informant provides a detailed description of this Ford Excursion, its location, Cannon's residences. It provides a description that's sufficiently detailed to enable the officers ultimately to locate that that vehicle and to stop that vehicle. And because that information was based on firsthand observations of Anderson regarding Cannon and Harris and their drug trafficking activities, the fact that, again, they were in this green Ford Excursion with Arkansas license plates, and that Anderson had personally and firsthand seen all those things, and because Anderson had personally and firsthand seen and been approached by Harris and Canada to take some of this cocaine and had been shown some of the cocaine, and particularly because of Anderson's proven track record of reliability. He had assisted in prior investigations both with Detective Pascio and other members of the Milwaukee Police Department, and his cooperation had led to the seizure of, on numerous occasions, of firearms and controlled substances, and also had resulted in successful prosecutions. All those things viewed together, again, established that the information he provided was reliable and was credible, and viewed collectively, the knowledge that the officers had clearly established probable cause to support the stop of the vehicle. And with that, unless Your Honors have any further questions, I would rest on the government's brief with respect to the third issue and simply conclude by asking that the court affirm the conviction, the judgment of conviction of the district court.
Thanks, Mr. Hanson.
Thank you.
Mr. Newman?
The government acknowledges that of this case, in terms of their ability to prove the existence of a conspiracy by a preponderance of the evidence, hinges on the credibility of Corey Anderson. And the government then seeks to convince this court that Mr. Anderson is credible. However, it's really because of the function that this court plays, it would be inappropriate for this court to make a determination about the credibility of Mr. Anderson simply based on arguments made by counsel without an opportunity to view the witness's demeanor or see him testify. To the extent that counsel argues that some of Mr. Anderson's testimony is corroborated, or some of the things that Mr. Anderson testified to were corroborated, it's Mr. Harris's position that Mr. Anderson manufactured information about Mr. Harris's participation. And so it's altogether possible that he had information about Mr. Cannon and Mr. Cannon's drug activities, but that he decided to create a story about Mr. Harris's participation, again, in an attempt to curry additional favor with law enforcement, as he acknowledged that that's what he was doing. Again, as we stated, we believe that that there were errors committed here. Those errors were not harmless, and at the very least, the district court should have an opportunity to render a determination in the first instance with respect to whether the government proved the existence of a conspiracy and the other 801D2E elements by a preponderance of the evidence. We ask for that relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Newman, I want to thank you for undertaking the representation and ably representing Mr. Harris.
Thanks, Judge.